Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a fresh look at something we think we know pretty well, Russian literature.
Yeah, usually when you say that, people instantly think, you know, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, long winters, suffering.
Right, and that whole idea of the mysterious Russian soul. Big beards, maybe some vodka.
Exactly. But that image, well, it turns out it's largely a constructed myth. It's often a narrow male-dominated view that sort of defined the conversation for a long time.
So today we're aiming to unpack that, maybe even dismantle it a little.
We are. Our guide is Katrina Kelly's fantastic book, Russian Literature. Very short introduction.
And our mission, really, is to absorb her main argument that Russian literature isn't some isolated mystical thing. It's dynamic, messy even, deeply tied to empire, global influences, and a lot of voices, women, non-Russians, that often got pushed aside.
Yeah, we want to give you a more critical, nuanced, frankly, a more real way to think about this tradition.
Kelly doesn't just accept the classics as, you know, untouchable sacred texts.
No, not at all. She asks why certain writers became classic in the first place, what power structures were at play, whose stories got sidelined. It's about redrawing the map, really.
Okay, so let's talk about our guide here, Katrina Kelly. She's a major figure in this field.
Oh, absolutely. Professor of Russian at Oxford, solid academic background from Cambridge. She's definitely a leading voice on Russian culture.
And what makes her perspective stand out?
Well, it's her interdisciplinary approach. She doesn't just stick to literary analysis. She pulls in cultural history, anthropology, gender studies. She sees literature as, like, woven into the social fabric.
So a poem isn't just a poem.
Right. It's also a historical clue. It tells you something about the society's anxieties, its hopes, its blind spots.
And she looks beyond the usual suspects, too, right? Things like childhood history, visual culture.
Exactly. That broad scope is key. It allows her to challenge that traditional focus, you know, the almost exclusive fixation on the big 19th century male novelists. She asks how they got put on that pedestal.
It's a critical revisionist eye she brings.
Definitely. Pushing past the romantic cliches to find something richer, more contradictory, and honestly, much more interesting. A tradition spanning centuries with poets, satirists, even sci-fi writers.
Okay, let's dive into the book itself. A very short introduction. Sounds simple, but it's not just a timeline, is it?
No, not really. It's more like a conceptual toolkit. It challenges your assumptions right from the start. Kelly's main goal is to kind of replace that old myth, the Russian writer, as the saintly prophet figure.
And replace it with what?
With a more grounded picture. Writers as real people involved in the messy cultural and political world of their time. Active participants, not just voices from above.
And it covers a huge span of time, nearly three centuries. How does she organize that?
Thematically, mostly. She explores how geography shapes identity, how that whole cult of the Russian writer was actually built, manufactured almost, and crucially, how literature was used to forge a national identity while the empire was expanding.
And this is where she broadens the definition of literature itself.
Yeah, massively. She insists we look beyond just the big realist novels. Poetry, drama, satire, journalism, even popular stuff like commercial fiction.
Because if you only read Tolstoy and Dostoevsky,
you get two geniuses, absolutely, but you miss a huge part of the story, the stuff ordinary people were actually reading and talking about.
Okay, let's start with that big myth. The writer as prophet or martyr.
Right. This idea that the Russian writer is the nation's conscience, somehow pure and above it all. Kelly says, hold on, that's a historical construction.
So it didn't just happen naturally, it served a purpose.
Precisely. It really took shape in the 19th century, partly because the autocratic system didn't allow for much open political debate. No real free press, no parties, so literature had to do the heavy lifting.
It became the space for everything else. Politics, philosophy.
Pretty much. The only relatively safe arena for hashing out big ideas.
But here's where it gets tricky, isn't it? The figures we think of, like Pushkin, often became national heroes after their death, canonized. Yet many of them, Pushkin, Tolstoy, Turgenev, were actually nobles, landowners, part of the very system they sometimes criticized.
Yeah, that's the core contradiction Kelly highlights. How could they be both insiders and the national conscience?
How does it mean is that?
Performance, essentially. They use their high social status, a status granted by the system itself, to offer social critique. But it was framed as high culture, as moral guidance, not raw politics. It had to be acceptable.
So a very careful balancing act, a performative role.
Exactly. Necessary for influence, maybe even for survival.
Okay, so if the writer's role was shaped by autocracy, what about the stage itself? The landscape, the geography of Russia?
Kelly argues it's not just a backdrop. It's deeply political. Literature uses space to define what Russianness means and, importantly, to justify the empire.
Can you give an example?
Well, think about the classic contrast. St. Petersburg versus Moscow. Petersburg is the artificial Western-looking capital imposed by the state, think Pushkin's bronze horseman, that image of state power.
Right. Versus Moscow, which is seen as the ancient, authentic, maybe more traditional heartland.
Exactly. So the land itself becomes part of this ongoing argument about Russia's identity and direction. It's not neutral territory.
And this extends beyond the heartland.
Yeah.
To the frontiers.
Oh, absolutely. Places like the Caucasus, Siberia. They aren't just settings for adventure stories. In the literature, they become colonial spaces where Russian identity gets defined against the other.
Like the Siberian exile stories.
That's a huge one. It becomes the central myth of Russian suffering, endurance, even heroism. But it's framed through that imperial lens.
Which leads us directly to the role of empire in all this.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly says literature and empire are inseparable.
Yeah, she argues that literature actively helped define Russianness, often by contrasting it with other groups within the empire. Poles, Ukrainians, Jewish communities, people in the Caucasus.
So the literature we inherited, the traditional canon, it's mostly from the perspective of the imperial center. Moscow and St. Petersburg.
Overwhelmingly, yes. And that naturally tends to sideline or ignore the perspectives and writings coming from those different ethnic groups on the peripheries of the empire.
She mentions Gogol's Taras Bulba, right, as an example.
Yes, it's a complex one. It shows how literature engages with Ukrainian identity, but through a lens shaped by imperial narratives. Themes of identity are constantly being worked out, often in ways that later political movements grab onto.
But hang on, couldn't someone argue that these works are classics just because they're great art, regardless of the politics? Where's that line?
That's a fair question. Kelly isn't saying they aren't great art. She's saying their greatness, or at least the recognition of their greatness, is tied up with their political context. They resonated because they powerfully voiced the concerns of the dominant culture.
Which meant other potentially great works might have been ignored.
Exactly. If they didn't fit or serve that dominant imperial narrative, they had a much harder time getting recognized or preserved.
Okay. And the final piece here is the woman question. The canon is famously male-dominated.
Mm-hmm. But Kelly excavates this whole history of women writers, arguing they've been significant contributors since way back in the 18th century. They were just systematically marginalized.
Pushed into minor genres or just not taken as seriously.
Right. She brings figures like Karolina Pavlova back into view, and then you have the huge figures of the 20th century like Anna Akhmatova and Marina Tsvetaeva. They completely redefined what female poets could do, often under incredible political pressure.
And what about the famous female characters created by male authors, like Anna Karenina?
Kelly suggests we need to look critically there, too. Often, she argues, these portrayals tell us more about male anxieties concerning women's changing roles and emancipation than they do about authentic female experience.
Wow. So the women in the books are reflecting the male psyche as much as anything else.
In many cases, yes. It really underscores how literature wasn't just reflecting society or politics. It was actively doing politics, shaping perceptions.
Okay, let's try and pull these threads together. How can we use Kelly's critical approach in our own lives?
Well, first, that idea of deconstructing the writer-prophet myth. The key takeaway is that writers, even great ones, were pragmatic players, not saints.
Right. So apply that skepticism today. Look at modern cultural figures, influencers, anyone positioned as a moral guide.
Exactly. Ask, who benefits from this image of infallibility? Are they really outside the systems they critique? Or is there a performance involved, maybe tied to their own success? It encourages a healthy questioning of narratives.
Okay, second theme, censorship. Kelly calls it perversely creative.
Yeah, this is fascinating. Because writers couldn't speak openly, they developed this incredible skill for subtext, allegory, satire. Aesopian language, she calls it.
Like talking about the weather when you really mean the government.
Pretty much. And that skill, reading between the lines, understanding subtext, is incredibly valuable for us today, isn't it?
Definitely. You can use it to decipher tricky emails, political spin, media messages. Understanding what's not being said.
It teaches you to find meaning, even when things are constrained.
And the third big message, inclusivity.
Yeah.
Moving beyond just the usual suspects.
Yes. the need to actively seek out women writers, voices from marginalized groups, different genres like sci-fi or detective stories that were popular but maybe dismissed by high culture critics.
So the practical application is diversify your own reading or media diet.
Right. If you only consume the greatest hits as defined by old power structures, you're getting a biased picture. Broadening your sources gives you a much richer, truer understanding of any culture.
Kelly phrases some of these ideas really powerfully in the book.
She does. This one really captures her core approach. Russian literature should be understood not as a sacred mirror reflecting a mystical national soul, but as a dynamic workshop where the very idea of Russia was hammered into shape, debated, and constantly redefined.
That completely changes the frame, doesn't it? Literature as an active force, a tool, not just a reflection.
Mm-hmm. And on the writer myth, she's quite direct. The cult of the Russian writer as a prophet and martyr is one of the most powerful and misleading myths of the national culture. These were real people operating in a complex political world, not saints in a literary hagiography.
Pulling them off the pedestal to actually understand them better, humanizing them.
Exactly. And one more on censorship. Censorship was not merely a destructive force. It was a perversely creative one. It fostered a unique literary culture of subtext and illusion.
Which explains so much about the depth and complexity we find there. Constraint leading to innovation.
Precisely.
You know, what really struck me diving to Kelly's work was realizing just how much place and geography aren't just settings. They're active forces loaded with symbolic meaning, shaping ideology. That whole Moscow versus Petersburg thing, it's like a philosophical debate played out in architecture and literature.
Yeah, that's a powerful point. And for me, the lasting insight, the thing I hope listeners take away, is that Russian literature isn't some quiet museum. It's a loud, ongoing argument about power, identity, and what it means to be human. And crucially, how we tell that story, who gets included, whose myths we repeat, that's a deeply political act itself. It shapes how we see the past and maybe the future, too.
A much more dynamic and contested view than the old cliches.
Mm-hmm.
Really makes you want to read differently.
Definitely.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.